This episode is brought to you by Zenith Exhibits. Zenith Exhibits provides website development, search engine optimization, and podcast production services for small business. If your website is feeling old and gloomy, give Zenith Exhibits a call and support the people who support this program. Visit www.zenithexhibits.com or call 208-209-7170 to learn more. Welcome to The Conservative's Guide to American Politics. My name is Ed Bejarano, and I am an otherwise happy-go-lucky conservative who enjoys life in North Idaho with his wife and two golden retrievers. For all intents and purposes, I keep to myself and figure folks should live and let live. You know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But I am frustrated watching the news. All I really tune in to see is the weather and maybe some local interest stories, but most of what they show me is their political bias and socialistic tendencies. The American media is no longer neutral. Instead, they use their megaphone to influence political power. The ideals of America have been hijacked by people who otherwise dislike or hate American ideology. I started this podcast as my way to fight back from my little slice of America. Call it a rallying cry for other common sense conservatives to arm themselves against the onslaught of negativity. It is time the America-hating progressives hear from the silent majority. It is time for conservatives to stand up and be heard. Welcome to Conservatives Guide. My guest today is a nationally published virologist who has spoken out against the current pandemic plan being administered by the Biden administration and Tony Fauci. So, without doubt, this episode will be blocked by every big tech company in the world. For that reason, I'm going to ask you, my listener, to share this episode with all of your friends. Also, please take a moment to add a 5-star review on Apple so other people can have the chance of hearing the words of today's guest. I know I don't make that request very often, but today's episode is going to be obvious why I'm asking that today. I need to stop here and explain what is happening in big tech and connect it to today's topic on the pandemic response. One can argue this episode has been over 2 years in the making. I started podcasting because I found it could get around Google and Facebook censorship and deliver actual words to the hearts and minds of American voters. I invested a small fortune of my own time and money to bring this communication channel to the point where it is so that I could present controversial information that would otherwise be censored by big tech. While Google and Facebook will not allow this episode to be shared on their platforms, the podcast ecosphere, at this point anyway, does not have a mechanism to remove podcast content. The content will live forever on the internet, and Americans, heck, people all over the world, will be able to reference what is said today and share directly with their friends and family. The more people you share today's episode with, the higher the likelihood that people will be saved. Okay, I know that last part sounds too pie in the sky, right? Well, not when you hear who today's guest is. Dr. Stephen Hatfield is a specialist physician and a virologist with a military background and separate master's degrees in microbial genetics, radiation biochemistry, and experimental pathology. In 2015, he trained and helped establish the Rapid Hemorrhagic Fever Response Team for the National Disaster Management Unit in Kenya, Africa. He has numerous peer-reviewed scientific publications. When the COVID pandemic broke, President Trump called on Dr. Hatfield to help with the response. He has a new book out and is with us today to talk about the potential effects of forced vaccines on children and, more importantly, what we all can do to better protect ourselves from mass fear and the COVID-19 pandemic in general. Dr. Hatfield, thank you for taking time to come on the program today.
Good morning, Ed.
So let's start with, I gave a short bio. Honestly, I could have talked for 20 minutes just with your introduction on information that I found during my research. But for the listener's benefit, who is Dr. Hatfill?
That's a good question. I've served science and medicine the best ways I can, with contribution to the overall public good to the best of my ability since I became a doctor. Whether it's treating patients in the slums of Cape Town or in the middle of the jungle, looking for viruses or dealing with pandemics, which I essentially devoted the last decade to studying pandemic response and planning. I wrote a book on this, 3 seconds until midnight, with my findings. Although it's oriented towards influenza, it's applicable to any RNA viral, rapidly mutating respiratory infection. And this was published prophetically about 2 months before the U.S. outbreak of COVID-19.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about your book, but how did you, I got a lot of friends who went into the medical field. How did you choose this field? What was your calling to go into infectious diseases and pathology like this?
Probably started with HIV. I was at the epicenter in South Africa when this occurred. We had 70 cases, which quickly multiplied, and we're talking back in the 80s, mid-80s, into hundreds of thousands. And I watched the tremendous devastation that this caused. And it started to focus me. I always had an interest in emerging infectious diseases. I was at USAMRIID under a National Research Council fellowship for a couple of years, where I worked on the Ebola virus. And of course, my instructors in virology were from the National Viral Institute in Sandringham, Johannesburg. So you realize that the 21st century was going to be the era of pandemics. And right now we're getting roughly one new pathogen that we've never seen before, jumping from animals into humans each year. Sometimes much more than one. I think 2015, there were like 8 new pathogens never before recognized as being human infections that jumped species. So something in 1995, something happened to the world as a whole. And we started to see this dramatic increase in what we call emerging infectious diseases. This is very worrying.
Now, and do you have any idea as to what happened in 95 or why this increase?
Yeah. We think the human population reached a critical point, combined with aerial commercial airlines, where viruses that were once hidden deep in the forests and jungles of remote areas were coming under threat from human incursion. A drop in animal species, we call it a reduced biodiversity. And these viruses, when you go into Borneo or somewhere, that is a unique environment, and it has its own viruses there. And you start disrupting this with palm oil plantations, cutting down the trees, destroying the forest. The animals die off, but those viruses that the animals carry are going to find new hosts. They're superbly genetically equipped to do this, to jump species. And they do. And this looks like where the predominant number of emerging infectious diseases are occurring. And we crossed a threshold somewhere around 95. And if we look at influenza, we can see the same thing. About 4 dominants strains and variants of influenza A. And then suddenly in 1995, here's this plethora of new influenza viruses that are very pathogenic, trying to jump into humans and adapt to humans. Majority of these have done very poorly. They're not properly transmitted from person to person with great efficiency. But it shows Mother Nature is trying.
But this isn't the first time in human history that we've had this kind of rapid outbreak. I mean, we can go back just about every 100 years on the dot, it seems like. We've got a major outbreak that reduces the population significantly. I think they call it the J curve. Is that the population J curve? Is that right?
Well, what's different now, and we all thought we were in the 90s, we thought we were imagining this. Wow, this is unusual. Wow, another pathogen. Wow, what's going on here? And then there have been several summary research reports where people actually went back and counted this. And no, we're not imagining this. This is real. And it's a dramatic increase every year, almost. So something has happened globally. And the only thing that springs to mind is the loss of high biodiversity areas and these viruses finding alternate hosts, which include man. When you combine that with modern air travel, you know, I've been in the middle of the jungle in Malaysia, and 24 hours later, I'm lecturing students in the United States. That's well within the incubation period of anything.
Right. Yeah.
So this is...
Yeah, mobility has certainly increased to the point where, yeah, we can now rapidly move anything from anywhere to anywhere.
The greatest vector, the greatest transmission method for infectious diseases is modern commercial air travel.
Wow. Now, what was your role in the Trump administration?
I was called in as an outside advisor to the Office of Trade and Manufacturing Policy. We had a national pandemic plan in 2005. It was a reasonable plan that was put together by some very smart people at the National Security Council. And it dealt on previous biological warfare defense measures that had been carefully studied and implemented at the end of the 90s. And it had even been exercised by what were called top-off exercises. And this could be adapted to local authorities. The key to managing a pandemic isn't what the government does from the top down. The key is what the local authorities, your local mayor of your little town and your civil administration of your little town or your suburb. Local authorities are the key. And if a local authority can handle the outbreak of an infectious disease and the sudden surge of and demand for medical resources and doctors, then a country as a whole, a state as a whole, and a country as a whole can manage their pandemic successfully. So the focus was always on the local authorities. And Department of Health and Human Services under the Bush administration actually supplied money to local authorities and tried to get them to plan and do this and that. All this disappeared under the Obama administration, seriously. And the members of the National Security Council that were involved with this were fired, essentially. They weren't asked back. One guy was left, and Ambassador Bolton fired him when he came into the National Security Council. So the plans were all forgotten and shelved and completely unprepared.
And was this,
we're witnessing the product of that.
Was this for the sole goal of giving the federal government power, do you think?
the original pandemic plan? No.
The No, not the original plan, but Obama's refusal to continue with local administration rather than what they're doing now.
Well, it doesn't really fit the socialist agenda, does it?
Right, right. That's scary. I want to dive into the meat of today's topic. I'm going to ask a direct question. Is the vaccine being mandated by the Biden administration technically a vaccine? And if not, why not?
No. There's four of these messenger RNA preparations. The Pfizer biotech COVID-19 messenger RNA, quote, vaccine, and its parallel product called Comirnaty in Europe, was created to protect against the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And this is the virus that causes COVID-19. The FDA classifies it as a CBER-regulated biological product. They don't classify it as a vaccine. They don't say that it will protect you against infection. They said when it came out that it was effective in reducing the severity of COVID-19 once an individual is infected with the virus. It's an experimental treatment. It falls under the Coronavirus Treatment Acceleration Program. It is not a vaccine. And the data currently, at most, it only provides about a 6-month period of protection against serious infection by the very early strains of the COVID-19 virus. Now, your listeners need to understand that virus that these mRNA vaccines were developed against effectively no longer exists. They've mutated into other, what we call viral clades. Chiefly the widespread Delta variant is now what's encompassing the world at the time. And it's quasi-species, in some cases, are vaccine resistant. They escape this early viral biological preparation. So right now, these mRNA vaccines do not reliably protect against COVID-19 infection. They never did. Fully vaccinated individuals can and are being infected with the Delta strain of COVID. And even worse, if we look at the amount of virus in a fully vaccinated individual that's now infected with Delta strain, it's at the same level as what would happen to an unvaccinated patient that came down with COVID. And fully vaccinated individuals that are newly infected can transfer their infection to both the unvaccinated as well as other fully vaccinated individuals. This is all reference literature, peer-reviewed literature. The big point that the Pfizer injection would reliably protect against more severe disease is not holding water either. An Israeli study of 2.5 million patients found that fully vaccinated individuals were actually 6 to 13 times more likely to get infected with this Delta COVID variant than individuals that had become infected and developed a natural immunity. And the reasons for this: in a natural infection, your immune system will make countermeasures against a lot of different parts of the virus, a lot of different proteins that a single virus might have. When you're given this mRNA preparation, you're only given immunity to one single protein, the spike protein. And if your naturally acquired infection from a previous COVID-19 case, you have a cross-protective immunity. So when these minor variant strains appear, your immune system still recognizes the virus. It's not doing that if you receive the mRNA vaccines. You only have immunity against the spike protein. In addition, the Israeli study showed that the risk of developing symptomatic COVID-19 was about 27 times higher among fully vaccinated individuals and their risk of hospitalization was 8 times higher compared to individuals with a natural immunity. So essentially, this Pfizer COVID-19 biological product / quote vaccine no longer reliably protects against infection, reinfection, viral transmission, or death from COVID-19. You're going to call it a vaccine, then you have to call it a failed vaccine.
Right.
This was confirmed on the 26th of August of this year when the CDC Director Walensky stated that the COVID vaccines no longer prevent vaccinated individuals from catching or spreading COVID-19. This was the time when Dr. Fauci came out and said, oh no, you're vaccinated, but you still have to wear a mask. He's not giving you the full truth when he made that statement and why you still have to mask up. Yet, the biggest problem in this whole thing has been the biased mainstream media and the CDC itself. They immediately responded by publishing an early, deeply flawed, and statistically small study claiming that the COVID vaccines could provide greater protection against reinfection than natural immunity. At this time, there's over 79 international peer-reviewed, high-quality research studies that demonstrate naturally acquired immunity is far superior to that and longer-lasting than that provided by the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines, which will only last about 6 months.
So, okay, so if natural immunity is superior to the government-forced vaccine that technically isn't a vaccine, and people with comorbidities have a higher chance of death from the virus, then what forms of treatment do you recommend so people can survive the virus and develop natural immunity?
Well, I'm not recommending anything, personally. All I can do is describe what the literature shows. And there are over 300 papers that show the Trump administration was on the right track. Hydroxychloroquine has proven to be a safe, effective outpatient treatment for COVID-19. And we know much more now, 18 months later. There's a number of drugs, ivermectin and some supplements, that if these are given as a multi-drug therapy, reduce COVID mortality by 80%, even with comorbidities. But the key is that you have to give these treatments early. Look at it this way. When your kitchen stove catches fire and the flames are leaping up, you go to the sink and you pour a big pot of water and you throw the water on it and put the fire out. You don't wait until the drapes and the entire kitchen is in flames and the fire department arrives. It's too late.
Right.
It's not going to work. Well, for COVID-19, that bucket of water are these early outpatient drug treatments. And these were intentionally suppressed by Dr. Fauci, by Dr. Janet Woodcock, who was divisional head of the equivalent of drug safety at the FDA at the time, and promoted by Dr. Rick Bright, who's openly admitted on television that he sabotaged the use of this.
But to what effort? Why? Why did they prevent the therapeutics like ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine from coming on the market in order to treat the people who are sick?
This was a complete mystery because Rick Bright he's a brilliant man, there's no doubt about it, but he's not a doctor. He hasn't had training in pathology, in cardiology. Janet Woodcock at the FDA is an internal medicine specialist. She's had rheumatology training. And hydroxychloroquine had been safely administered to patients with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and other connective tissue disorders for over 50 years with an excellent safety profile, no cardiac events. But instead of giving an investigational new drug authority, which we needed because our friends had donated hydroxychloroquine to the United States, or the active precursors to make the drug. By March, into March, I think it was, we had 62 million doses of this drug in the National Strategic Stockpile. But because it was donated, they did, you know, obviously the our friends didn't want this sold on the market for other uses. It was for COVID, so we needed an investigational new drug authority. It's a simple piece of paper. Okay, you can use this off-label. Doctors could do it anyway, but the way they had set it up was that if it had an IND, investigational new drug authorization, then you could use it from the national stockpile for COVID. And its use for patients with other things like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, their supply wouldn't be disrupted. Well, what happened, Janet Woodcock phoned Rick Bright the day after he was tasked to work with the FDA. Rick Bright was the director of the Biological Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA, to work with Janet Woodcock at the FDA to get a investigational new drug authority, simple piece of paper. She phoned Rick Bright and told him this was a very highly dangerous drug and that it should only be given to hospitalized patients because it can cause severe cardiac rhythm disruptions and death. Well, that's complete nonsense. This has never been reported in the millions of people that have been given hydroxychloroquine for in doses much larger sometimes and for longer periods of time for other conditions. So anyway, Rick Bright seemed to know it all, and he ignored three levels of orders from the president, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and the Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services for essentially pandemic preparedness. And he worked with Woodcock to issue, instead of an IND, what's called an emergency use authorization, and the fact that this drug should only be given to hospitalized patients because it's very dangerous.
Wow.
And it's pretty trash.
Well, you know, the danger of dying from a virus untreated seems to be far more dangerous than using a drug that's been on the market successfully used safely for over 50 years. To me, it seems criminal. I mean, I'm not asking your opinion on that one, but it just seems like somebody should go to jail over this.
There's 333 research papers that essentially show what you've just said. Peer-reviewed research. Doctors were still, because they saw dramatic effects this was having for early treatment, people were staying out of the hospital. They were sick for a couple of days, but they stayed out of the hospital, and they developed superior natural immunity, not just to the strain circulating at the time, but to some related strains that were eventually going to appear. You cannot vaccinate yourself out of an RNA viral pandemic of this type, because you're always going to be one step behind the virus, as we're seeing now with the Omicron strain. This was intentional, and we couldn't figure this out until Janet Woodcock was promoted, went over to the vaccine development people, and had to recuse herself from any vaccine decisions because of her conflicts of interest. Now, this is all published. This isn't something someone made up. Rick Bright was fired for his insubordination, and he immediately filed a whistleblower complaint. If you go to, I think it's page 43, you can get his whistleblower complaint off the internet. And he states, this was causing very dangerous, you know, cardiac side effects, and this drug had to be stopped. And in fact, it was the virus that was attacking the heart, not the hydroxychloroquine. And the early use treatment studies, unfortunately, it took until July. The New England Journal of Medicine would publish the original Ford study. But in July, early use hospitalization treatment with hydroxychloroquine came out. And by early, I mean, if you walked into the emergency room or were wheeled in and you were short of breath and the physician judged that this could be COVID, you were given hydroxychloroquine on the spot. And when their study came out, the New England Journal of Medicine refused to publish it. One of the senior editors, I believe, is on the outside panel for the FDA for vaccines. But they refused to publish it. International Journal of Infectious Disease published it after sitting on it for a couple weeks. And it showed a 51% reduction in mortality. Immediately, the FDA said, no, this is rubbish. You know, these patients were on steroids. Well, fine. Now we've got a combination therapy.
Right, right. Steroids. Go with it.
Obviously something there. And this paper was followed within a few days by a Mount Sinai study that showed essentially the same thing, and by a later Spanish study that shows a 61% reduction in early hospitalized patients. You need to remember, COVID is a two-part disease, COVID-19. The first part is an upper respiratory tract infection, like the worst cold you've ever had in your life in some cases. After about 7 days with these early strains of the COVID virus, it gets into your lungs. And this is what starts the shortness of breath. At this stage, you only have a couple days where you can act. Once you've entered this more severe second stage, nothing's going to help you. Okay? Some will still survive, but some will die. Because it triggers a whole immune thing in your body, and you're just completely overwhelmed. You have to be given this within sort of the first 5 to 7 days at the most from the onset of symptoms. And you need to remember that the CDC had completely messed up the ability for rapid testing because of incompetence, essentially. And by the time you got your test back, and under the protocol, they couldn't give you hydroxychloroquine until your test came back positive, you were already in the second stage. So all these papers that were being written at that time were essentially late patients, where nothing is really going to help them, and that's what the study showed.
Wow. So they publish a... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, doctor.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So they... I just want to catch the listener up, because I want to transition to something that about children. So they have a non-peer-reviewed study that says it causes heart conditions. And so they're going to go with other treatments that don't have any provability, no peer-reviewed studies, and has shown to be a completely failed approach in favor of going towards this vaccine, which technically isn't a vaccine. And for the last 18 months, they've just been pushing and pushing and pushing the vaccine, demanding that everybody get vaccinated, regardless of whether you've had COVID or not. But recently, they've now declared the vaccine safe for children. And I've read some studies, and I read some reference material in preparation for today's interview, that children are especially susceptible to heart problems with this vaccine. Can you talk a little bit about that? What should parents know before they allow their child under the age of 12 to be injected with any of this stuff?
Well, in 1990, the FDA and CDC together created what's called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. We shorten that to VAERS, V-A-E-R-S. And this was to receive reports about suspected vaccine side effects. We got a lot of vaccines out there of different types. The system was grossly antiquated when it was initiated and characterized by serious event underreporting. In fact, I think it was in 2009 we had an H1N1 strain come through of influenza. And it was causing, the vaccine was causing Guillain-Barré syndrome in a number of patients. And the VAERS system was only able to pick up on 35% of these. Now, Guillain-Barré is very serious. It's a paralyzing condition. You can't mistake it for anything else. But it just didn't get reported on VAERS. To report something on VAERS takes you about a half hour. It's a very non-user friendly system for doctors to use. And although they're mandated to do it, when you've seen 40 or 50 patients during the day, you're worn out. You don't have time to sit there and type in this stuff to an FDA database. And this is what happens. So you would think before administering a highly experimental, quote, vaccine, messenger RNA vaccine, to millions of people, that you would establish a superior real-time vaccine adverse event tracking system. And they never did. So in the first 4 months of their introduction, these experimental COVID-19 vaccines had racked up more deaths and severe adverse events on theirs than all other types of vaccines combined over a period of 10 years. These vaccines should have been pulled from the market at that time. And what's even more terrifying, we don't know. There's no way to predict who is going to get one of these rare but deadly vaccine side effects. And while these vaccine side effects are rare, when you're giving it to millions of people, you're going to have thousands of deaths. Okay? What's happening, what we were seeing now when they extended it down to young males, was the development of inflammation of the heart, myocarditis. And they brushed this off as, oh, well, it's only mild myocarditis. You don't have any such thing as mild myocarditis. There's going to be some scarring inside the heart. When you're having this at a young age, you need that reserve when you get older, right? When you get into your 60s and 70s. So this is just one of the things. There were tremendous, horrific clotting episodes occurring. People losing their legs or their lower legs, having to be amputated from clotting of their arterial system. Infarcts, blood clots in their spleen, liver, the venous sinuses in their brain. We've never seen some of this stuff before, really. And it's made even more troubling that these vaccines weren't pulled, because we now have these, as I said, early use multi-drug cocktails we can give patients. That can cause up to an 85% reduction in COVID-19 hospitalization and death. These are the same drugs that were incorrectly suppressed by Dr. Fauci at the NIH, Dr. Janet Woodcock at the FDA, and even more outrageous, just before the end of the Trump administration, Dr. Stephen Hahn, who was the commissioner of the FDA, Janet Woodcock is now, by the way, but Stephen Hahn at the time, on a radio program, He was following all the developments with hydroxychloroquine, because we had a doctor's chat room, and his name was just before mine on the email list. And he was following all this stuff, and he got on a national radio program and stated, yeah, I think hydroxychloroquine does something. Well, if you thought it did something and you're following this that closely, why didn't you reinstate the EUA? Now, without making accusations, we find that Dr. Hahn is now the senior medical advisor for the venture capitalist firm that backed the Moderna vaccine development.
So it always comes back to money.
I'm not making accusations
But it seems to be. Right.
Yeah.
You know,
this is outrageous.
It's frightening. It's more than outrageous. It's just downright frightening. This is like Armageddon.
Well, it's criminal.
Yeah.
Now, Washington Post has had this information for months now. I wrote a letter. They wouldn't publish it. I wrote a letter to the government accounting office. Never heard back from them. People want to keep their jobs.
Wow. Now, you wrote a book. You wrote a book that kind of outlines the issues with pandemics in general. It came out just a few months before the COVID pandemic. But tell us about 3 seconds until midnight. I assume, for the listeners, I assume the book title is based on the doomsday clock from our nation's past.
Yeah. Remember in the 50s? Well, you don't remember.
No, I do. I remember it. Yeah. 5 minutes to midnight, 1 minute, and the clock kept ticking. Yeah.
Yeah. And it still exists. It's from the, I forget which organization publishes it, but it's the nuclear people that publish it. And at midnight is when catastrophe occurs with reference to nuclear war. But it served as a good thing for pandemics. And we knew something was going to happen. We all thought it would be influenza. But we knew from 2015 about the SHO14 strain that could directly pass from bats to humans. And we're not going to get into origins of the virus in this talk because...
No, we don't need to at this point.
The Chinese are blocking any investigation that's tried to be done. But we knew something was coming. And so the first part of the book, and it's for lay people, you may have to go back a couple pages, but if you stick with it for the first part of the book, you can make your own decisions about the rest of the book. We try to teach you about RNA virus pandemics and what happened in 1918 with the influenza A strain that suddenly turned lethal during World War I. And with that understanding, what happens when a virus passages from an animal through humans until it learns to live in the humans, and then it becomes more efficiently transmissible. And the fact it can either become a milder disease or it can become more lethal. You can't sort of conclusively predict what it's going to do. Most of the time they become much less lethal, which leads us into this new Omicron variant. But we take it through there, and then you can't just put out doom and gloom. We go over the 1918 pandemic and how it was managed successfully back then in Philadelphia. Philadelphia was a nightmare. It was a corrupt local authority, city government. Everybody was on the take, and it just fell to pieces. And bodies were being stacked like cordwood at the morgue. And again, as always, it hit the most disadvantaged areas of the city, like COVID did here today. And a volunteer force was formed by very influential, wealthy people that were leaders in business. And they came into the city and they got it back on track. And they were able to accomplish a great deal and bring order back to a collapsing city infrastructure. So there were very important lessons to be learned here.
Kind of bringing the thesis back to what you started this episode with, and that is local response to a pandemic is more effective than a national response.
Well, if your local authorities will do the things they need to do early, then the local authorities are able to manage their own outbreak. And if the local authorities can manage their own outbreak, then the nation can manage its outbreak.
Right.
There's things the federal government needs to do, and this is what the Trump administration did. Immediate search for effective drug therapy. Yes, you start vaccine development, but you can't have a vaccine for every infectious disease. It's impossible for some of them. And by vaccine, people hear the word vaccine, they think of measles vaccine and chickenpox vaccine and, yellow fever, smallpox, polio. These were successful vaccines, but they were only successful because these viruses mutate very slowly, the ones I've mentioned. Some are DNA viruses. They mutate very slowly. So RNA, measles is one of the most infectious diseases we know. It's an RNA virus. But it's very complicated, and to get through the vaccine, to break out of it, you need at least 5 simultaneous mutations in 5 different proteins. And that can take 100 years to develop naturally. So these vaccines are very long lasting. This is not the case with respiratory syncytial virus, influenza, or COVID, the COVID-19 virus. These things mutate very, very quickly, as we've seen. And while it was promoted, vaccine development, it was well understood that we might not be able to have an effective vaccine unless we could find a universal portion of the COVID-19 virus that wasn't mutating rapidly, and provided we could mount an effective immune response against that segment, and providing we didn't cause a worse disease.
Right. Provided that the treatment wasn't worse than the disease itself.
Right. So basic common sense showed that you needed the key to managing this, and other countries did do this, by the way, successfully, until they quit using hydroxychloroquine because of, I don't know why, because cardiac events were not being caused by early use treatment. The cardiac events that were being caused by patients on hydroxychloroquine were hospitalized patients where the virus was attacking the heart, and the FDA never admitted that this was occurring. We now know hospitalized patients were developing these fatal arrhythmias that had never even taken hydroxychloroquine. And with modern tissue culture and organoids, we now see that the heart is a target organ.
Right.
So well, these vaccines and, well, go ahead.
So how do people get your book? How do people buy 3 seconds until midnight?
Oh, it's on Amazon.
And I'll include a link. You have a website, 3secondsuntilmidnight.com, right?
Yeah, I've tried to write papers concerning the things we've talked about here that are referenced from the literature, from peer-reviewed literature. It's Dr. Stephen with a V, Hatfill, H-A-T-F-I-L-L, .com.
.com, right. And I'll have both URLs in the show notes for today's episode. Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with the listeners before we wrap up?
We've seen that the Hahn, Fauci, Woodcock doctrine of vaccination in the middle of a pandemic is not working. You can issue boosters all you want. This virus is always going to be a step ahead. It was never going to work. The key to controlling, and we know from other countries, Panama, for example. Panama is a very good, Switzerland, very, very good. If you will do outpatient drug treatment, you can control the pandemic. Developing new drugs for in-hospital treatment is a fine thing. But it's not. None of them are going to work that well in severe patients. And you ban hydroxychloroquine, one of the safest drugs known to medicine. You ban ivermectin. You degenerate it and destroy the peer-reviewed research on it with propaganda. And now you're bringing out, Merck is bringing out a oral tablet with, it looks like they've overstated what they put in their application for an EUA. It's not working as well as was promised. It causes mutations in your normal cells and tissue culture. And apparently, I'm getting the word that there's some toxic bone marrow effects, which is very alarming. And you watch, this so-called drug safety people are going to pass this. It's already been shut down once for I forget what drug, what agent they were trying to push it for. It didn't get through the safety review. But it's so crooked now. You watch. They're going to approve this outpatient treatment, molnupiravir, and it's already failed one safety assessment years ago by the FDA. It'll probably get approved this time, and now they'll push that as instead of safe hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and this multi-drug combination, which shows over 80% really effectiveness at keeping you out of the hospital and reducing mortality.
Well, Dr. Hatfield, you're right. It's going to be all over, and we'll have you back on the program here in a few months to share the words of your prediction, because I know you're going to be right. They've just been pushing stuff through for the last 19 months that apparently they know won't work over stuff that they know will work. So naturally, they're going to go the route of most likely failure. So, Dr. Hatfield,
last thing to add.
Go ahead.
A new Alzheimer's drug has just been approved. It doesn't work. I think a couple scientists resigned over the decision to allow it. It's going to add $25 to your Medicare bill for every person on Medicare. It's about $50,000 a year to give an Alzheimer's patient this drug. And it doesn't work, and yet it was still approved under the Janet Woodcock gene.
So go for what fails. That seems to be their motive operandi.
What makes money.
That's right. Wow. Well, Dr. Hatfield, thank you so much for the time today. I really, really appreciate you sharing your expertise with my listeners.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
This has been an episode of The Conservative's Guide to American Politics. We hope you've gained new knowledge that helps you in your day-to-day struggle to navigate the minefield of liberal ideals. Please share this episode with your conservative friends and help them gain the strength needed to face the progressive assault against America. The stance we take today will determine our future and the future for our children. Like this podcast and help send a message to the progressives. Stand proud of your conservative ideology. Bring together your neighbors and look not for the shelter of silence. Speak your mind, exercise your right to free speech, or one day the idea of America might only be a note in history.